session number 24570, reel 1.
Piers Plowright, reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Plowright?
Yes, I was born in London on December the 30th, 1937.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background?
My father was a GP, general practitioner, working in North London. Although I have a very, very English name, Plowright, maker of ploughs, my father was half Polish, his mother was Polish. She was a physiotherapist, I suppose, stroke actress. I never quite knew about that. And my mother was entirely Swiss-German, although lived most of her life in England. So I really only got a quarter English. My father worked in Hampstead and Highgate and stayed on during the beginning of the war and then joined the RAF and went to southern Italy and North Africa, working in hospitals. He was actually on Vesuvius when it erupted in 1942-3, I can't quite remember, but wasn't blown up. He got out of the way in time. My mother looked after me. We were evacuated to Wales, my sister and I, Abersoch, and I remember the war in various little glimpsy ways, which you might like to know about.
Could you give us an idea? Because you were very young, two to six sort of thing, two to seven. Can you tell us just how the impressions you've got?
Well, the war, as war, didn't really register at all in the way perhaps with children it doesn't. The only thing I remember that was kind of violent was a blazing plane coming down over a field. And it might not even have been in Wales, because we also went to Buckinghamshire for a bit. And all I remember is people looking up at the sky and this thing coming down, probably a German plane, and a lot of kerfuffle and people rushing out to see if the pilot was alive or dead. And I didn't know whose side anybody was on. I just knew it was an enormous, rather exciting moment, bright light coming through the sky, crump, and something in the field. I also remember in Wales people looking up and saying, pointing up at some sort of a fight, although it wouldn't have been the area for the Battle of Britain at all, would it? But anyway, something was going on in the sky, a dogfight of some kind. Otherwise, my war memories are very much to do with the radio, and it's interesting that I ended up with a career in radio, and they were to do with news broadcasts, solemn voices, my mother looking very attentive, the Itmar coming into the kitchen, and again, I didn't understand the jokes, but my mother laughed a lot, and I could see it was sort of good. And in a strange way, I understood that there was a crisis on and people needed to laugh. I can't quite explain that, but I did. The only way in which the war really impinged on me was between the Welsh children and the English children, because the Welsh didn't like us. And my sister and I used to get done up, or done over, as we came back from school up the lane, by the Welsh kids who'd lie in wait for us. And there was a definite feeling of we weren't welcome, not by the general populace, but by a lot of the kids of our own age. We were sort of namby-pamby London kids.
Did that endure? I mean, was it something that went away as you stayed there? Or?
I remember it. I don't remember friendly relations with the local children. The school I went to was full of refugee children, evacuated children, rather than Welsh children. And it was run by two rather English ladies, whereas a lot of the people in Abersoch spoke Welsh. I remember one or two nice things, like being put up in a Welsh house when we first arrived, and there were five brothers, and they all sang, you know, the classic Welsh family. And they'd sing to my sister and I when we were tucked up in bed at night, sort of a close harmony Welsh singing at the end of the bed. And that was very attractive and friendly and warm. And I remember the chapel with the singing coming through the stained glass as we came up the hill in the evening.
Did you miss your father much?
Didn't think of him. Fathers were absent figures. And when he did come back, I have a feeling he came back on leave once. We were sort of didn't know quite what to do with him or he with us. And then after the war, he was back and drove us back from Wales in the rain, I remember. And then he was part of the family. But because he was a very busy doctor, in a way he didn't play a great part in my childhood compared to my mother, who was my educator, my inspirer, gave me a love of history, of London, of French, all the things really tended to come from her. Later in life, father became very important.
Now, what about when you got back to London? Where were you educated in London?
In London, I went to a little preparatory school. Let me say my sort of social background, middle class, fairly comfortably off. Not as comfortably off now, I realise now, as I thought I was then. My father kept up appearances, but in fact, for most of his life, he was struggling to make ends meet. But we lived in Church Row, Hampstead, which is an extremely nice street. He never bought the house. He could have got it for 7,000 quid. He rented it for 40, 50 years and left it. And by that time, it was over a million, you know. One of those things you didn't sort of think about. Anyway, brought up there in comfort, went to this preparatory school called Arnold House, which is in St. John's Wood.
What was it like?
Yes, the school. The school was interesting. Straight after the war, it was, although a boys' school, there were a few girls there. And there were a few women teachers, because men were still being demobbed or hadn't come back, and children hadn't found a place to go to school. So we had the strange thing of lots of rather glamorous women teachers, but we had to call them sir. They didn't seem to mind that. And the girls were sort of boys, really. I mean, they were just brought in with the lot otherwise. And then gradually they dropped away, mostly men teachers then. Some who'd come back from the war with odd twitches and limps and bad tempers. Never went into that, but they'd obviously been through something. What did I know of the Second World War? Really only, I do remember VJ Day. I think I've got that right, because my father was home.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I remember going to Piccadilly Circus on his shoulders, and a fantastic feeling of goodwill and non-violent jollity, and people picking you up and hugging you, and everyone, you know, I know this is often said, but it did seem like there was a total sort of universal happiness. And if people got drunk, they didn't kick each other, they just hugged each other. And I just felt this was marvellous, this is how I wanted life to be. But I don't have any specific memories. I do remember people in uniform. I do remember girls kissing the people in uniform. My father wasn't in uniform by then. His wing commander's uniform, I still have in a cupboard upstairs somewhere, and I used to dress up in it with his hat and everything. And they were like relics. He got Distinguished Conduct Medal of some kind. I have the certificate somewhere. But he was medical, and he was working, as I say, in Foggia and then in North Africa, treating people in hospitals.
Now, what was your next school after?
After that, I went to Stowe School in Buckinghamshire, keeping the sort of middle-class tradition. Hated the idea of leaving London, being sent to the wilds of the country. But it became a school that I loved, partly because its wonderful landscape, magnificent house, but mainly because I had a wonderful history teacher who was an ex-army man himself called Major Bill McElwee, who'd got, a DSO, only one lung. I think that was a wound. Amazing. He'd been a student of the great German historian at Christchurch. Oh dear, it'll come back to me. Well, he was at Manchester, and Louis Namier, pupil of Louis Namier, and he was a rigorous teacher, Bill McElwee, but an inspiring one. And he taught me to write, and he taught me to think historically. He was an expert on the Emperor Charles V. And he'd also written on military strategy, on Clausewitz and people like that, I think for his thesis. He introduced me to Plato and political thought. He took me to Bismarck and the 19th century. He was very good on the Tudors and Stuarts. He was half Irish, so he knew a lot about Irish history. And he was a very inspiring character. And no doubt that shaped my next move, which was to Christchurch, Oxford. But before that, there was national service.
Can I ask a bit about what was life like? We're quite interested in the public schools. What was a sort of typical day like, if you could take us through it?
Yes, I could. A day at Stowe, well, let's start when I was young. It was still quite rigorous, the public school. I mean, you got up early. You didn't have cold showers, I don't think, but you expected to be down for breakfast and you were beaten if you were late, that kind of thing. Caning was still going on, and nobody seemed to worry about that. It was perfectly normal. It was a bit painful, but it was quick. We had assembly, so we'd go down, we'd get up quickly. Of course, I was just shaving for the first time, and that was always a mess, and collars. Nobody remembers these now, but we had collars with studs, and that took ages if you'd never done it before, and knotting your tie right, and all these things. I mean, I had a tie at Arnold House, but it was much more of a ceremony, and they were terrified about being late, and bells were ringing, people shouting at you, and it was a public life, too. It wasn't at all comfortable. I mean, there were 22 boys in my dormitory. And at lights out, it was silence. And if you were caught talking again, you were beaten. Take you through the day. So we got up, bell, somebody shouted at us, quick wash and shave, got this collar sorted out, down to the huge main hall, which is very beautiful, just before 8 o'clock. A bell rang. And a funny little side thought, a remark about this, is that people were always executed in those days at 8 in the morning, and hanging was still on. And I remember the somberness, if it was, I particularly remember John Reginald Halliday Christie, the day he was executed. I couldn't help thinking of him as we were going into breakfast at 8 o'clock. Somebody would stand up and shout out, "Get into hall!" It was fairly sort of strident, semi-military. And we all processed in, sat at these tables, and we'd have breakfast. The thing I particularly remember was Spam, which I absolutely loved. Nobody else did. Fried Spam. I wouldn't mind it now. And eggs and things. You know, I had a full breakfast. And there was a Latin grace for all meals. But just per Jesu Christum Dominum Nostrum. Amen. Then we would go to our lessons. First class began at 9. And the lessons were... Again, we had some inspiring teachers, a great English teacher, a very good German teacher, funnily enough, a bit of an eccentric, an ex-major from the war, who had a frightful accent, but didn't sort of matter. And we loved his eccentricity, and we thought he was about 108, he's probably only 30-something.
And what sort of teaching methods did they...
Teaching methods were old-fashioned in the sense that it wasn't much sort of group work. The teacher taught and you listened and wrote. And there was one geography teacher, I particularly remember now, appallingly brutal man. We called him Slug. He looked like a slug. And he taught you definitions. What is a rift valley? What is a river? What is, you know, statistics about rainfall and things. And if you thought you weren't listening, he chucked the blackboard cleaner, which was made of wood, extremely hard, straight at your ear. And cuffed you and did things that for now he'd be prosecuted. We were terrified. And I never liked geography as a result of that. You had that. That was the worst kind of teaching. The best kind of teaching was my history teacher, my English teacher, who we read poems around the class. Learning by rote was still a thing, which I rather approve of, you know, in terms of poetry. I think it's a very good idea. We would, after that, we'd have a break in the middle of the morning. I think we could go to the tuck shop and buy things for ourselves. Milk was, of course, the thing in those days.
Would rationing be off?
Rationing was more or less off, wasn't it? It went on surprisingly late. I'm talking about 51 to 56.
That's when you were at the school?
That's when I was at Stowe. Rationing was still at Arnold House, where we had milk every break. Sorry, I'm digressing a bit.
All right.
After break, we might have PT, as it was then called, not PE, and it didn't matter what the weather was, snow on the ground, we got into our blue shorts and white vests, and we were out doing press-ups and, you know, waving our arms out in the freezing cold for half an hour, and then back for a second lot of lessons, and then lunch, and then always games, compulsory games, and I was no games player, and I tried to find ways of dodging rugger, which it was in the winter, and cricket, which it was in the summer. I managed to become scorer for cricket, so that was all right. And eventually, as I got more senior, I had the option of cross-country. And the great thing about cross-country was you could skive off, unless the masters were looking, hide behind a tree and be seen running at the end. So there was a lot of that sort of stuff. A friend of mine used to keep cigarettes in various trees dotted round the estate, so he could be sure of a puff. So the sort of healthy effects of cross-country were completely wasted. I wasn't a smoker. I was a bit of a child prig and thought, well, if they're all smoking, I won't. So I never did. Afternoons, compulsory games, I think 3 days a week. But there were nice things like archaeological societies, the Vitruvian Society, which was historical, and went to visit houses.
Tell me about the societies.
Vitruvian Society was run by my history teacher, and it really meant... I forget who Vitruvius was. Was he a historian or an architect? But anyway, we went off to stately houses like Blenheim. Once a year, we'd go to London. Big excitement. And I joined the Young Farmers Club, which was fairly flourishing, because there were a lot of sons of farmers at Stowe, mainly because for the Smithfield show every Christmas, we got to London. And I would be seen going through the door into Olympia. And then I would skate out the back door, meet my mother for lunch at a French restaurant in Soho, and then come back again at the end. So I wasn't doing much good to the young farmers, but I was getting a day in London. And you see, London was still my mecca, really, and I loved the holidays.
And after games or...
Then we'd have evening school. Well, that was from about 5 o'clock till 6:30. Then we'd have chapel. We didn't have morning chapel. We had morning assembly, which I don't think had any prayers, maybe announcements. But evening chapel always, in this rather austere low church chapel. The foundation of the school had been rather low church, I think because Mr. Roxburgh, the first headmaster, was a kind of Scottish Calvinist. They were a very tolerant, open man. But you know, he came from a low church tradition, so there was no cross on the altar, there was a sword. And the sermons I most remember were from military men, like we had Colonel O'Heck of the American forces in Britain. And I remember him starting now, and he said, "And Samson stood up, and he put the brands on the fox's tails, and he laughed and laughed and laughed." And I hadn't the faintest idea what this was to do with religion or anything. But Colonel O'Heck, I can see him now, he was very big with lots of medals, full uniform. And we had an ex-bishop from India who spoke all the time about the 14th-something Lancers riding into Delhi in a Durba. Again, you know, not much to do with religion, lots to do with military life. Although we weren't a military school, there were quite, again, a lot of sons of military people there. And so there was a bit of a military... The Corps. Everybody had to join...
Now, this is the Officer Training Corps.
It's called the CCF, the Cadet...
Combined Cadet Force.
Combined Cadet Force. And that you had to join willy-nilly, unless you could prove perhaps you were a Quaker or something. I don't know. They never gave me... I just did it. And that was my first experience of the smell of Blanco and Duraglit and boot polish... and drilling, and firearms. We had a wonderful Gothic temple, which is now actually English heritage, and you have to pay about £600 a week to hire it. But in those days, it was the armory. And there was a little sergeant, peppery little man, ex-Second World War, I suppose, who used to snap at you, and you drew your rifle, and you pulled through, and you cleaned it, and you appeared on parade. And we must have gone to firing ranges, but I don't really remember that. I just remember drilling with the rifle.
How did you take to drill? I mean, fort drill.
Didn't... Well, in the army, it's another story. I grew to love it. Here, I found it was a nuisance. I wasn't coordinated. I had a sense of rhythm, and I loved the military music. We had a school band. I didn't play in it because I wasn't that musical. I mean, not a musician. But I loved the sound of military music, and we had an annual inspection every year when some top brass chap came, and we all saluted and marched past, and the band played... and we were inspected. And something in me, I suppose, a slight theatrical sense, and the beauty of standing on this great lawn if the sun was shining with the 18th century Capability Brown Garden behind you and the great lake and the arch. I loved all that. But military life as such wasn't anything. I didn't enjoy the Corps afternoons very much. And we had a very odd CO who taught maths when he wasn't a CO, and he was called Freddie... Dear, he couldn't pronounce his R's, and he had a little dog. He wasn't unpleasant, but there was something a bit snide about him. I wasn't very happy. He could be quite witty, but I didn't take to the Corps. I survived.
The lack of rhythm, does that mean you had trouble marching?
A little bit, although I got it later on. I got it when I finally came to the army, came up against real sergeant majors. You know.
Were you actually training towards Cert A or anything?
Yeah, we had to take Cert A. So we had to do also cross-country routes, marches, find your own directions, learning things like put stick your hand on your head, and that means close up on me, and read maps, and getting lost in particularly dirty rivers. Buckinghamshire's full of nasty rivers called, was it the Ouse? And it smelt, and you smelt for days after, and you fell off ropes, you know. I was always falling off ropes into rivers.
Did you actually take it and pass it?
Yes, I passed it. I must have passed it. Yeah, shouldn't think very high, but I got through.
And what about in the evening? Was there a prep period? Or
yes, sorry, then to take you through chapel, supper, and then prep, which was from about 8... till 9:30, collective, until you got into the sixth form, you sat in this big house room, invigilated by a prefect, absolute silence, and got on with your work, whatever it was. It was a lovely 18th century room with glorious ceilings, but scuffed with boys' boots and penknives, and we each had a locker in which we kept our prized possessions and cakes from home and everything, you know. There was a piano in the corner, which one or two boys could play, a notice board, beautiful view out, and this is where we did our prep. And then there was a bit of free time, and then there was, I think, bed and baths were about 9:30, something like that, and lights out were by 10:30, something like that, an absolute silence. And if you were caught talking, as I was, down to the housemaster in your pyjamas and beaten on the spot.
I wanted to ask you about disciplines, and perhaps are overly harsh, but perhaps not. What was the system of discipline, and was there prefects involved, or was it
almost... Yes, no, prefects were involved. It didn't have the awful tyranny one often hears of sort of bullying prefects who roasted you in front of a fire, a la Tom Brown school days. They could be a bit nasty. I mean, we had the fagging system, you know, that is a small boy being a servant to the prefect. In a, but I had a very tolerant succession of people, and you toasted stuff. You know, it was silly, really. You sat there with a toasting knife, toasting their bread for them while they stuck their lordly feet up on a chair and spoke about whatever, blood sport or fine art or girls they'd been dating, you know. That was when you were very young. And then you moved on, and of course you got from the dormitory, you went to a four-bed dormitory. And finally, if I remember, we got sort of two beds, and we had studies in our last year, but not to sleep in. So you shared with one other person, but it was a room with two desks and your own pictures and gramophone records and so on. Discipline, on the whole, was an odd mixture of the very relaxed, particularly if you've got... For instance, I would go to school, go to tea every weekend with my history tutor and his eccentric wife in an amazing, batty little house down about a mile's walk from Stowe, where extraordinary people would come, like Kurt Hahn, the founder of Gordonstown, and Peregrine Wursthorne, was editor of the Telegraph and Big Noise. He was an ex-pupil of my history teacher. We had the famous Lady Russell, who'd been involved in the Russell divorce case. And talk was very uninhibited, unbuttoned. We heard things we shouldn't have heard, and it was exciting. MPs came, but I can't remember who. Bill's politics were, I suspect, Tory, but he wasn't sort of narrow Tory. So we get literary people, we get writers. Gavin Maxwell, who wrote all books about otters, and I think about his military career as well, came. It was an extraordinary atmosphere there, and we were allowed to say what we liked. We helped with the washing up, we cut the grass, we helped muck out the ponies. The daughter, Harriet, was a keen pony rider. And in return for that, we got tea and cakes and conversation and lots of gossip, quite scandalous gossip about the other masters, which, you know, we weren't supposed to repeat, but inevitably it got round. That was the sort of jolly side. And the art teacher, Michael Manzi, we used to work with him clearing the swamps and things, and he gave me wonderful lectures on Italian civilization, which I've never forgotten, with rather, by our standards today, boring black and white slides, you know, no colour. But I was spellbound by that and went on a history tour, a culture, we were called culture vultures, and we went, once a year, Bill Mackle, we took a group of boys, they had to pay, to Italy, and we went Florence, Siena, Ravenna, a few other great cities. So that was the good side. The tough side of discipline was beatings for small offences, no argument, like talking after lights out. Sex and discipline, of course, homosexuality was never mentioned. I never experienced it, I must say. Whether I missed out on something, I don't know. It obviously happened, and a very good friend of mine was expelled, and there was a terrible silence that fell over the school. We just knew he'd done something naughty with small boys, and he went. And no argument about that, no attempt at counselling, out. Sex education was quite amusing because, again, my father had explained to me just before I went to school about the facts of life, which took me completely by surprise. I mean, nowadays a boy of 13 not knowing anything would be extraordinary, but I didn't. Anyway, we had a doctor called Dr. Livy Noble, known as Dr. Livy Nobles, of course, by the school. And he turned up with a little black bag and various charts, and we'd all go into the library, and he'd explain reproduction and orgasm and things to us, and a lot of sniggering went on. It was all very silly, really. That was sex education, but it was a repressive in the sense that you didn't... If you talked about it, it was the usual schoolboy smut. Homosexuality happened, but was instant expulsion, again, if discovered. Beatings happened for... I think you could be expelled also for heterosexual sex, in the sense that I remember a very senior boy getting one of the maids pregnant. There were women in the kitchen and sometimes cleaning the rooms. We had matrons as well, but I don't think they ever got pregnant. So he was out as well, straight out. So in that way, it was fairly tough. Sorry, you have a question?
Well, the overall ethos of the school, was it guided towards the more academic boy? I mean, you know, or was it guided towards the sporting heroes?
Funnily enough, there was a kind of division between aesthetes and bloods, rather as there was later, I found, at university. And those who were clever, people like Bill McElwee, would single out, although he himself was a hunting, shooting man, he was very good at seeing the plants that needed careful nurture. But there were other teachers and housemasters who took a rather different view and thought that sport and the whole man were the thing. And I was lucky enough, though I wasn't that academic, but I had a, you know, I was on the aesthetic side to find scope. In drama, too, I did a lot of acting, and we had two or three teachers, a man called Joe Bain, who taught English and French, and was rather young and wore colourful waistcoats, and was generally not like the usual sort of teacher. He did a lot of extraordinary productions of plays like Pirandello's Henry IV, which opened my eyes and ears to I'd already been keen on acting, actually. But here was a chance, so I did a lot of that, and that was lovely. And music. Music tradition was very good. I just sang in the school operas and choirs and things. I wasn't a big noise, not a soloist.
What qualifications did you take? You said you went to Cambridge, but...
Oxford. I scraped into Oxford. I scraped through everything, really. I scraped through school certificate, was it? Higher certificates. You know, I got enough. Maths was appalling, and I had to take three goes even to get through school certificate, but I did finally. History and English were my strong points. And I got... Stowe had a special connection with Christ Church, Oxford. So I went for an interview for a scholarship and a paper, but didn't begin to get high enough marks. But I did get a place. And then, I don't remember there being any debate in the family. This is the summer of 56, so Suez is blowing up. Hungary hasn't quite, but the world's a bit sort of fluttering. The question, should I do national service first or university first? And I don't remember choosing it, but I did national service first.
Now, what was the call-up system, as you remember it, that you went through to be called
up? I just remember a letter coming to my father. Can that have been right? You see, that's...
Were you still at school?
I was at school till July 56. And around that time, I have the feeling, and this is a bit hearsay and memory, that a Buff envelope arrived at Church Row, care of my father, which called me up to join the Royal Fusiliers, because that was my... It's like catchment areas for schools, isn't it? That was the local regiment. At the Tower of London, on the 4th of October, 1956. And I had a sort of summer of escapism. What I do remember is on the train coming home, the special train to London, at the end of my last term, making jokes about being sent to Suez and being in the desert. And I said, showing off a bit, but dreading underneath, well, lads, I shall be probably firing live ammunition in the desert in a few weeks, ho-ho. But it didn't happen, because anyway, Suez has sort of blown over, didn't it? I can't remember the dates, but it was pretty quick.